A few weeks ago, we had a fellowship lunch during which we marked Mike's retirement from the eldership. And in his little address, you remember Mike gave a potted history of our church. But what Mike presented verbally then, his description of the church's foundation and the addition of new elders and the gaining of a building and all the rest of it, you could, if you wanted, present visually, couldn't you, by way of a timeline along a straight line with notable events marked on it at appropriate intervals. You're all familiar, I'm sure, with timelines. And I want you to imagine this evening, then, the ultimate timeline, not NREC's timeline, but history's timeline, an all-encompassing timeline from the very beginning to the very end. I want you to imagine that. And with that timeline in our minds, then, I have two headings. And first of all, clarifying our location accurately. Clarifying our location accurately. We're going to do things a bit differently this evening. For quite a chunk of our sermon, everything indeed that I'm going to say under this first heading, I'm going to make no reference at all to our text. That might sound an odd, even an irresponsible way to proceed, but I'm hoping that the background stuff that I'm going to talk about now will make the text come alive much more when we do eventually get to it. And so by this first heading, clarifying our location accurately, I mean clarifying our location on that timeline that I mentioned, history's great timeline. Where are we? What is this period that we're living in? Well, of course, for us Christians, the most basic answer to that is it's the AD period, or the New Testament period, we could call it, or the New Covenant period. That is to say, we're living after that momentous cluster of events recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. And because we're living after those events, we are not BC people like Moses and David and Ezekiel. We are AD people. That's where we are on the timeline. And that's true. But more needs to be said. It doesn't quite clarify our location accurately enough. You see, a couple of those events recorded in the early part of the New Testament do more than propel us simply from BC to AD. They propel us further. They are more seismic than that. I'm thinking of Jesus' resurrection on the one hand, and the outpouring of the Spirit on the other. What's particularly significant about those? Well, this is what's particularly significant about them. They are both associated in the Bible with the end. Resurrection is supposed to happen at the end. You remember Martha's words to Jesus. He has said to her, "Your brother will rise again," talking about Lazarus, who is lying dead in the tomb. And her response, you remember, is, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day," John 11:24. And she's right. Martha knows her scriptures. Resurrection is indeed a last day thing. It belongs to the end. And similarly, the outpouring of the Spirit is supposed to happen at the end. This cursed and withered cosmos is going to be reanimated and revitalized as the Spirit is poured out upon it. Isaiah 32 verse 15, "Until the Spirit is poured upon us from on high, and the wilderness becomes a fruitful field, and the fruitful field is deemed a forest." Psalm 104 verse 30 speaks of the same thing, of God sending forth his Spirit to renew the face of the ground throughout this decaying creation. The outpouring of the Spirit brings about the rebirth of the universe. It belongs to the end. And if then resurrection and the outpouring of the Spirit belong to the end, and if on Easter Sunday morning resurrection occurs, and if on the day of Pentecost the outpouring of the Spirit occurs, then it isn't sufficient to say things like, well, we're now in the New Testament period. The situation's more dramatic than that. The end has come. That's the reality. The end has come. We can think of it like this. When I was a teenager, one of Britain's great athletes at the time, some of you will remember him, was the hurdler Colin Jackson. Colin Jackson was known, among other things, for his lightning-fast starts. Once in an interview, he was asked how he managed to fly out of the blocks so quickly, and his answer was, I go on the B of the bang. I go on the B of the bang. So whereas you might assume that a bang is just this short, sharp thing, to Colin Jackson, it was this stretched out thing. And you could be at the B of the bang, or the A of the bang, or the N of the bang, or the G of the bang. And similarly, we might assume that the end is just a short, sharp thing, a moment that suddenly erupts into being. But it's not like that. It is, in fact, a stretched out thing. With the events of Easter Sunday morning and the day of Pentecost, the E of the end transpires, to use Colin Jackson-type language. Perhaps in 2024, we're somewhere between the E and the N, or perhaps between the N and the D, I don't know. But the crucial point is that we're within the end now. The end is not some remote, way over there phenomenon. It has been set in motion already by Jesus' resurrection and by the outpouring of the Spirit. It has been set in motion and we are within it. That is our location on the timeline. And it means two things. First of all, it means transition. It means transition. And this is where I want to stretch you and get you thinking somewhat deeply. It means transition. The Bible talks about and contrasts two ages. The present age and the coming age. We could go to numerous texts that mention one or the other of those, or a few texts that mention both of them. Now, if the end were a clean, clear-cut line, then things would be simple. At that point, with the occurrence of the end, we would just step right out of the old age and right into the new age. But I'm saying that the end is this stretched out thing that has already been set in motion. Which raises the question then, do you and I inhabit the old age, or do we inhabit the new age? And the answer is, we inhabit both. This is a strange transitional period during which the old age and the new age exist simultaneously. They are both present. It's like when you're at a train station and you're standing on the platform and a long train is departing and its last carriage or two have almost gone past you when the front carriage or two of another long train going in the opposite direction also goes past you. And for a moment then, they are both going past you. The tail end of one, the nose of the other. And that's what's going on, the Bible teaches, right now. Because the end has now been set in motion, the old age is departing, but not yet fully gone, and the new age is arriving, but not yet fully here. There's an overlap that's presently taking place. But the train station analogy is ultimately inadequate because there, of course, you're just a detached observer. You're on the platform watching these two things going in opposite directions. But as these two ages overlap, we're not detached observers. I used a moment ago the word inhabit. We inhabit or participate in both of these overlapping ages in a way that certainly wouldn't be possible with those two trains. We straddle the two. You couldn't straddle two trains that are going in the opposite directions, but we straddle these two ages that are going in opposite directions. We exist simultaneously in both. We inhabit both of them. We participate in both of them. You see, I mentioned resurrection and the outpouring of the Spirit. But those aren't just events that we read about when we open our New Testaments. They have entered our experience, haven't they? Resurrection power courses through our veins as believers. We're alive this evening, raised from our former state of death. That's what we sang about in that second hymn, and particularly that last verse to which I drew your attention. We experience resurrection power as believers now. And as for the Spirit, he indwells us. He resides within our lives, which means then that you and I participate in the new age. If in some sense we have been raised to life, if in some sense the Spirit has been poured out upon us, those are experiences of the future age. And we are therefore future age people. Now we are. Already, this very hour, our existence bears the marks of the future age. And yet, at the same time, our lives also have much in common with everyone else around us, don't they? We live in houses, we do jobs, we eat and drink and sleep, we shop, we belong to families, etc., 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 etc. That is to say, we participate in the old age. And so you see what I mean about this straddling, then. A momentous transition is taking place. The old age is on its way out. The new age is on its way in. And as they weirdly coexist, we Christians participate in both. So the end has been set in motion, and that means transition. But secondly, it means trouble. It means transition, but it also means trouble. If the end has been set in motion, that is disastrous for someone in particular. I'm talking about Satan, of course. If we're now on the E, or the N, or whatever letter of the end, then for him, the game is up. The clock is ticking. His days of remaining influence and relevance are very much numbered. Which means what? Well, according to the New Testament, it means frenetic activity on his part. A kind of bitter backlash against his fate having now been sealed. Do you remember how it's put in Revelation 12, verse 12? He's in great wrath because he knows that his time is short. And so with great intensity, he causes trouble. He causes Christians trouble. He causes the church trouble. That's why you get texts like 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. But understand this, that in the last days, that's this period that we've been talking about this evening, this period in which the end has already been set in motion by the resurrection and the outpouring of the Spirit. In the last days, there will come times of difficulty, Paul warns there. It's strange, isn't it? I mean, Jesus' resurrection and the outpouring of the Spirit, how wonderful, happy events. And yet the immediate effect of them is trouble. Imagine you support a little football team. Let's say it's York City. And they're playing then away at some place like Millwall, where the fans have this reputation for being very tough and hardcore, and your team, York, wins the game. And it's a wonderful, happy event. You've won the match. But the immediate effect of that is that you've got to find your way to the train station afterwards and perhaps pop into McDonald's for a burger and try and avoid the Millwall fans who are chasing you and wanting blood because their team has lost against you. So this wonderful, happy thing has happened. You've won the match, but the immediate effect Further down the line, you'll celebrate in peace and calm, but the immediate effect is trouble. And that's how it is for us. The end has begun. And that is thrilling. That is epic. That is sensational. The thought should set our pulses racing. Isaiah could never say that. Jeremiah could never say that. Daniel could never say that. But we can say the end has begun. Wow. What a thing to be able to say. It should make the hairs on the back of our neck stand on end. But you need to understand the immediate effect is trouble. The immediate effect is trouble. The backlash from Satan is inevitable. So, clarifying our location accurately, I'm saying we are living within the end. And that means transition. We straddle two overlapping ages, the old and the new. And it means trouble. Satan is frenetic, clarifying our location accurately. But then secondly this evening, conducting our lives accordingly. Conducting our lives accordingly. What does all of this mean then for our lives? And this is where we come at last to our text, to 1 Corinthians 7:25 to 31. And this passage then comprises two parts. There's verses 25 to 28 and there's verses 29 to 31. And we have, first of all here then, a word to the betrothed. A word to the betrothed. This is verses 25 to 28. Now, you can see from your ESV footnotes that the word betrothed in our passage, it's literally in the Greek virgins, but it's clear from the context, and we're not looking at the whole passage tonight, but when you continue beyond the bit we're looking at, it's clear from the overall context that betrothed is the right rendering. That's particularly what Paul has in mind. So those then who have entered into an agreement that they're going to marry someone. And Paul then, speaking to them, to those members of the Corinthian church, notice in verse 27 that he doesn't encourage the breaking of that agreement. Verse 27, by the way, is still talking, I think, about betrothed. So when he says, are you bound to a wife? It's literally, are you bound to a woman? And I think he means in betrothal, he's not going back again to marriage and divorce. He's already dealt with that. He's talking about this new situation of betrothal. So are you bound to a woman? That is, are you betrothed to one? Do not seek to be free. So he's not encouraging then betrothals to be broken up. But at the same time, as he addresses these betrothed folk, you would hardly say, would you, that Paul is sending his hearty congratulations to them. I mean, he's pretty frank, pretty candid in what he says here. I mean, verse 27, he speaks to those who aren't in such an agreement. He says, do not seek a wife. In verse 28, he says, those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. So, as I say, he's not kind of saying, you folk who are betrothed, that's wonderful, I'm so pleased for you all. Tell me your wedding dates, I'd like to come along to them. No, he doesn't want those who are betrothed to break the agreement, but at the same time, he's giving this very strange perspective on marriage in these verses. And that's not then because he's just some unromantic old grump. He says why, doesn't he, in verse 26? He says it's in view of the present distress. And many people have thought then that this must be something specific to what was going on in Corinth at that time, or in the environs of Corinth. Perhaps there was some crisis that was unfolding, some famine or something like that. But I don't think that's what Paul means. I think when he talks about the present distress, he's talking about that trouble that I talked about earlier, that satanic trouble. By present, he doesn't mean just this very, very specific point. There's something going on right now in Corinth. He means the distress that characterizes this entire period, from the moment that the end began with the resurrection of Jesus and the outpouring of the Spirit, right up to when the end will end, when the D comes of the word end. There's this trouble that Satan is causing, this satanic backlash. And that's the present distress then that he has in view. Not something specific to Corinth, this particular year that he's writing, but this general satanic campaign that's going on from the resurrection and outpouring of the Spirit until the final return of Jesus. And one reason then that I say that is because he, when he goes on in verse 28, those who marry will have worldly troubles. The literal phrase in the Greek is those who marry will have tribulation in the flesh. Tribulation in the flesh. Which is a very, very similar phrase, is it not, to one that came up in our other reading this evening in 2 Corinthians 12. Paul talks there about a thorn in the flesh, a tribulation in the flesh, a thorn in the flesh. Very similar phrase. And of course, we know, don't we, that that thorn in the flesh, we don't know what exactly it's, what it looked like, but we know that it was satanic, because Paul says so. He says it was a messenger from Satan, was this thorn in the flesh. And it seems reasonable then that when he uses such a similar phrase here, those who marry will have tribulation in the flesh, he's talking about satanic trouble. Satanic trouble. So is Paul saying then that this satanic trouble that I described earlier on, Satan's backlash to the fact that the end has already begun, is Paul saying that that only applies to married people? Well, no, of course he's not. Satan gets at all Christ people, whatever their domestic arrangements. But at the same time, it does seem to be the case, does it not, throughout the Bible, that Satan has a particular thing about marriages. And he does love to get at marriages and sometimes to get through marriages. I mean, isn't that how it all went wrong in the first place? And Satan then, he got at Adam, who was, of course, his main target, because Adam was the one who mustn't eat the fruit. It didn't particularly matter whether Eve ate it or not. Adam mustn't eat the fruit. But Satan got at Adam through Eve. And this marriage then that was meant to be such a beautiful thing, it became this channel, this medium through which Satan wreaked havoc. We can go back to the beginning of the creation then, or we can go back to the beginning of the Christian church. And one of the first disasters that befalls it in the book of Acts is what? It's in chapter 5 when you have Ananias and Sapphira, a married couple. And they agree, Peter says, they agree to lie to the Holy Spirit. And Peter expressly says, Satan has made you do it. Peter links it to Satan there in Acts 5. He again has gone for this marriage in the Jerusalem church. What do you think of that passage we sang from the projector? Ephesians chapter 6. And as I said, introducing the song, we all know that passage so well, don't we? But we perhaps read it in isolation, just the section that's all about the battle, the warfare. And we miss where it comes in the flow of the letter to the Ephesians. Where does it come? It comes right after Paul has addressed the believers' ordinary everyday situations, slaves and masters, children and parents, and husbands and wives. Surely it's no coincidence that just after Paul has talked about these relationships, including the husband and wife relationship, he then says, and put on the armor, because there's a deadly enemy. Implying that this is where Satan often attacks. He attacks these everyday relationships of ours. He attacks marriages. Or we could just stay within 1 Corinthians 7 itself. And remember back in verse 5 of this chapter. And Satan has been mentioned there. And you've got this married couple. And they're practicing sexual abstinence just for a season. For the very worthy and noble reason that they want to have a concerted time of prayer. And Paul says, watch it, watch out. Because Satan might use that good motive, that noble aspiration. And he might tempt you through that to some sinful behavior. And so it does seem to be a thing, I'm saying, from beginning to end of Scripture, that Satan, yes, he causes trouble for Christians generally, and in this period we're living in, and the end has begun, he does cause trouble for Christians generally, but he has a thing about marriages. Which means that if tonight you're married, you need to be aware of that. He has numerous ways of attacking. Perhaps he can just make the marriage become very cold and empty and bringing no glory to God. Perhaps he can use a marriage to bring about sin, as he did with Ananias and Sapphira. Or perhaps sometimes he can try and just destroy the marriage altogether. I just heard last night of two university friends of mine, two Christian women, both been married to their respective husbands now for years, and one of them apparently for 6 years has been having an affair with the husband of the other. And these kind of things go on. Satan wants to get at Christian marriages. And we need to be very vigilant and very much on our guard against that line of attack. So a word to the betrothed. But then in verses 29 to 31, a word to the blinkered. A word to the blinkered. I mean, verse 29 is extraordinary, isn't it? Given everything that we've seen throughout chapter 7 thus far. Where Paul says here, from now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none. Now, it's precisely some Christians who are married living as though they weren't married that Paul has been correcting and attacking in chapter 7. Some of them, remember, had stopped sexual relations altogether. Some of them were seeking divorces. They were living as though they weren't married, even though they were married. That's what Paul has been dealing with. And now he seems to be telling them to do the very thing that he's been condemning throughout this chapter. What's going on here? Well, I think it reminds us that these New Testament writers were very wise pastors. And they knew that in any given community of Christians, there might be a predominant problem, but that would never be the only problem, and sometimes you would also have the opposite problem. I think you see it in the book of James, a good example, where clearly most of James's readers are poor, economically poor, and they are being exploited on the harvest fields, not paid their wages properly. And they're being dragged into court by rich oppressors. And again, James is dealing with issues surrounding that. But then do you remember how suddenly, is it in chapter 4, the end of chapter 4, suddenly he addresses those merchants who are saying, tomorrow I will do this and that, and travel here and travel there. And he tells them that you shouldn't make your plans for the future so confidently. And clearly then he's aware that, yes, most were poor and struggling because of their poverty, but there were one or two who were in a different situation altogether, the opposite situation. They had their own temptations to face. And I think then that explains how Paul can suddenly write like he does here in verse 29. You see, this is the thing. There are these two ages I said earlier in the sermon. And we, as Christians, straddle them. We're in a period where two ages coexist. And we participate in both. And in this Corinthian church then, many of the believers had this very blinkered approach where they could only really see their participation in the coming age. And they were obsessed with that. And we're already kind of living in the coming age, and therefore marriages are unimportant. And that was their attitude. And Paul has been dealing with that throughout this chapter. That was the predominant problem. This blinkered obsession with being part of the coming age. And anything that isn't to do with the coming age doesn't really matter. But Paul knows that there will be others in the Corinthian church. And that's not their problem. They're blinkered in the opposite way. And all they can see is their participation in the present age. And they're exclusively obsessed with that. And that is who he now turns to then and addresses in verses 29 to 31. And I guess for us, that's probably more likely to be our temptation. I suspect very few of us are far too preoccupied with our participation in the coming age. Most of us are probably far too preoccupied with our participation in this age. And when Paul says then that, you know, from now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, those who mourn as though they were not mourning, those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, we're not to take him literally. This is powerful rhetoric. Forgive me, another football illustration, but imagine then that the Man City have won the Premier League and it's all been very joyful and exciting, and then they meet to train for the new season. And on that first training session, the manager walks in and he says, forget winning the Premier League last season. Now, he doesn't mean that literally, does he? I mean, there's no point really in getting into football and football management at all if you win something and then you're not allowed to remember it for more than a few weeks. And he'll go home in the evening and look at the trophy cabinet and look at the photos on the wall and so on. He doesn't literally mean you can never again think about your victory last season. But his worry is that the players will now be complacent and think they can just stroll through the coming season. And so he's saying the opposite of the thing that he's worried about. He's worried that they'll be preoccupied with the fact they won last season, so he's saying forget winning last season. And that's the point here. Paul is worried that some Christians in Corinth, and worried that some Christians down the ages, and perhaps ourselves, worried that we might be preoccupied with this our participation in this present age. And so he's saying the opposite of that. He's saying forget the present age. Not meaning literally that you should forget that you're a married person, or forget the joy that you're having in your work right now or whatever. But he's making this point that you mustn't be preoccupied with your participation in the present age, because you're also a participant in another age. And so let's just challenge ourselves then as we close tonight on these areas that Paul mentions. So that's that rejoicing, that joy, that thing that's making you very excited and very joyful right now in your life. Perhaps the promotion at work, the academic success, the sporting success, the romantic relationship you're in, whatever it might be, that thing that is perhaps taking over all your affections and all your waking thoughts. It's not wrong in itself, and it's not wrong to be excited and joyful about it. But remember, there's more to your life this evening than just that triumph and that joy. That's a present age thing. You're also a future age person. A resurrection person. Alive with Christ now, the Spirit indwelling you. Remember that too, Paul is saying. Or that sorrow. That grief. That very hard thing that again is preoccupying you. And again, you can't get out of your mind. And it's waking you up in the night. And again, that's understandable. And Paul isn't condemning that. But again, don't let it swallow you up completely. Because it's a present age thing. It's part of the age that is passing away. And yes, you belong to that. But you also belong at the same time to a new age that's coming in. And remember that. Remember you're a resurrection person. With life coursing through your veins. The Spirit indwelling you. Even that marriage of yours, that marriage that perhaps has been going on for decades now, and you just cannot imagine yourself not in that marriage, and you're so deep-rooted and settled within it. And that's a good and healthy thing in many ways, but again, just remember, it's a present age thing. And your life is more than just your present age participation this evening. You're also belonging this evening to a new age. And make sure that that is reflected in your thinking and emoting as well. And you see then what Paul is saying. He's saying to us, let's make sure we're not blinkered, just focusing on one dimension of our two-dimensional existence. We're two-age people. We live in two ages. The Corinthians were too preoccupied on the one side. We're probably too preoccupied on the other. Let's make sure that we remember that those things that perhaps are consuming us and utterly obsessing us, they're part of an age that is departing. But we belong also to an age that is incoming. May God help us to think like that. Amen.